Layoffs and buyouts at the Kansas City Star are far from new, but the recent round felt particularly grim. Some of the most recognizable, most trusted names at the paper have now left the Star's ranks. Tony Rizzo, Lynn Horsley, our own Steve Kraske. What's been happening to the Star for more than a decade now has us wondering about the whole notion of the daily paper functioning as what used to be called the paper of record, the reliable, authoritative source of information that sort of defined what was commonly accepted as truth for a whole community. It's a status the Kansas City Star long maintained. Is that still what it is? And does that concept still hold weight? I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's what we're asking on KCUR's Central Standard. Later in the show, a look at the future of digital journalism. For now, let's stick with the question about papers of record. Dan Margulies, good morning.
Hey, Gina. Good morning.
So you worked for the Kansas City Star for a long time. You also reported on the Kansas City Star when you were at the Business Journal, and you report on it now for KCUR.
Yes.
Is that a fair summary of your relationship with the paper?
Yes, I'll add that when I was at the Star, I reported on the Star as well. Because somebody had to do it.
What would you say was the Star's role in the city when you first got to know the paper?
Well, you speak of a newspaper of record. That's a rather fuzzy metaphysical concept. And in a technical sense, there is something called a newspaper of public record, one which publishes public notices and legal notices. But that's not what you're talking about. That is a trivial sense of the word. What you're talking about, I assume, is a newspaper whose authoritativeness and breadth and depth of coverage can fairly qualify it to be called a newspaper of record, a sort of first draft of a community's history, if you will. So the question becomes, when a newspaper has shrunk so much that it's unable to devote the kind of resources to that far-ranging coverage that I'm speaking of, can it be called a newspaper of record anymore?
What is your answer?
And my answer is no. Now, you know, which is not to denigrate the Kansas City Star. The remaining journalists there do fantastic work, and they have done some great stories in the last year. You know, ones that pop into my mind are the stories about now Senator Hawley when he was Attorney General of Missouri and the lack of transparency in that office and his hiring outside people to basically dictate what was going on in that office. The lack of transparency in the state of Kansas. That series of stories was Pulitzer Prize-winning quality. So the Star continues to do great work, but it can't, with its shrunken news staff, give the kind of coverage that it once did.
So,
it doesn't
and I'm
have,
just making sure ahead. I understand mm-hmm. that your definition of paper of record, I mean, I find this fascinating, the first draft of the city's history.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, it's often said that newspapers and journalism are a first draft of history. And I would contend that if you want to be called a newspaper of record, then you have to devote the kind of resources to covering anything that is of significance in a community. And that is impossible to do now with the shrunken resources of the paper.
Again, I mean, is that arguably always impossible to do?
Yes. Just by definition, yes. But, I mean, if you're asking me to answer the question, is the Star any longer a newspaper of record? I would say no. And the Star is not unique in that respect. To the extent that we have any newspapers of record left in this country, I would contend that there are only a handful. You know, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post. And they are newspapers of record not so much because of the way they cover their communities, but because of the way they cover national and international affairs. Now, the Star and most local papers have pretty much given up on foreign coverage. So, you know, their métier is local coverage. And local coverage once upon a time meant covering everything, you know, from soup to nuts. But when you have when you're down to 65 reporters from 300 a decade ago, which is the case with the Star, then you can't do that.
I am curious, was the idea of the Star being a paper of record part of what drew you to work there?
Well, nobody ever spoke of, you know, at the Star of us being a paper of record.
But I know,
yes,
but
it's
back,
implicit. Yes, yeah. Certainly. You wanted to be part of the biggest game in town. You wanted to be part of an institution that had the resources to devote to in-depth coverage when that was called for. You wanted to have an institution that had your back when you were reporting something difficult, something controversial, something that might get you into legal hot water because the people you were writing about didn't like what you were writing about.
Is it your perception that the Star is no longer willing or able to do that?
It is willing. I don't think it is able because the finances, you know, the internet disrupted a paradigm that lasted for about 250 years. Newspapers were monopolies, essentially, in their own communities for the most part, right? And they could pretty much dictate. They were the only game in town when it came to print advertising. That, of course, is no longer the case. So, you know, we have seen such a massive diminution in readership over, I think from 2008 to 2017, newspapers nationwide saw a 45% decline in readership. The odd thing is that I looked at a recent Pew public opinion poll, and it showed, this is very disturbing to me, it showed that 3 out of 4 Americans believe that local journalism is in fine shape. Now, how you square that with what we know to be the case, I have no idea.
Well, I want to turn to another guest, Scott Reinhardy. He's with us from KU. He is a journalism professor, and he's the author of Journalism's Lost Generation, The Undoing of U.S. Newspaper Newsrooms. So, optimistic title, Scott.
Well, it is and it isn't. There certainly are some extreme problems here, and Dan has certainly pointed those out. Newspapers have always been seen as at least since the early 1900s, as the paper of record or the first draft of history, and that was made popular pretty much by the New York Times to start with. It was coming off the heels of yellow journalism in the late 1800s.
Can you define that? Because I think it is a phrase that still gets thrown around, but you have located it in a time period. Contextualize that for us. What are you talking about?
Well, when you're talking in the early 1900s, when newspapers are one of the few media outlets, radio isn't available, TV isn't available, you have newspapers, magazines, pamphlets, paper products, and newspapers certainly had a great hold on the markets at that time. They were vast, they were expansive, they were large, and they held all the news that people wanted to read for the most part, or at least that was the perception.
But coming off of the heels of yellow journalism, what is it you're describing?
Sure. Yellow journalism really was a time where it was the media wars, where sensationalism was predominant over facts and true information, what people really see as factual. They were looking, they were really much like scandal sheets or, as you could put, National Enquirer, the Star magazines that are of today. So that was really the concept of people wanted sensationalism. They wanted to hear about the celebrities. They wanted to hear what people in their neighborhoods were doing in sensational fashion.
In the 1880s.
In the late 1880s.
Unlike today.
Things, you know, always come around, right? So, and now you have different platforms with online, social media, and so forth. But yeah, that was really a time where you had the biggest newspapers in the country battling it out, trying to gain readership and trying to put out the most sensational, to some degree, propaganda that was available.
And so the paper of record, is there some sort of like turning point that gives rise to it, do you think, or like a philosophical impulse or just concern circulating in the country? What was it?
What really happens, and still true today, the stock and trade of newspapers is news and information. However, that is supported by trust and credibility. And when you're always throwing out sensational information that may not be factual, you're losing that trust and credibility. So by the 1900s, these large newspaper owners realized that they were losing audience and that they weren't as popular, that sensational aspect journalism wasn't really as popular as it needed to be. It kind of just ran its course, and they were starting to see depreciations in some of the readership. So they decided, you know what, we need to be a little better at actual reporting and more accurate types of journalism. that really had ebbed and flowed throughout history. But by the 1900s, particularly the New York Times, all the news it's fit to print was their slogan, still is their slogan. Really, they started to examine factual information and moving away from the sensational aspects. And that's when the popularity of the first draft of history and also the paper of record became more prevalent in this country.
Where certain outlets were really setting themselves apart in that way.
Absolutely. And then you started to really see distinctions on which papers were providing information that was factual and beneficial to a democracy, and then the papers who are still chasing the sensationalistic aspects of news and information.
So it's interesting to me that Dan's focus in talking about what distinguishes a paper of record has a lot to do with comprehensiveness, and your focus has a lot to do with credibility. Not that I think either one of you would suggest that those aren't both fine goals, but I the distinction is interesting to me.
Well, I think what eventually happened was newspapers of record, there were competitions. There were several newspapers in a community. And so to distinguish, newspapers started to build their staffs and provide more and more information. And then as they beat out the competition and those other newspapers closed, they still had this expansive idea of, we're going to cover the entire community or the entire, you know, the Sherman Williams model. We're going to cover the world. However, they demonstrated that's incredibly costly and expensive and difficult to do. So it was still built upon the principles of trust and reliability and credibility and accuracy. So those things are not two separate entities. They certainly are intertwined into what newspapers are trying to accomplish.
Is it your sense that there is a golden age where the paper of record as an institution was really just humming along at its best? People throughout the country, whatever city they lived in, were super invested in whatever newspaper performed that function in their community.
Oh, sure. I think you can run that from the 1920s to the 1970s, quite honestly. If you start looking at circulation and profitability of newspapers during that period of time, newspapers really flourished, but there were fewer and fewer options at that time. Now, as radio came along and TV came along, there was always the great worry that, oh, that's going to cut into newspaper profitability. And it did to some degree. However, newspapers maintained that standard of being the paper of record, to being the first draft of history, that folks would still turn to those entities to receive its reliable news day in and day out until TV and radio gained more footage in the marketplace. But it still didn't really damage newspapers. And even when the internet
broadcast
came along,
is ephemeral on some level.
It is. And then when the internet came along, newspapers had somewhat of the same idea. Radio never hurt us that much. TV didn't hurt us that much. Oh, we'll be fine. Well, as we saw, that has not quite worked out as expected.
You know, and so along those lines, when I think about the role of the Kansas City Star in Kansas City, just beyond the journalistic function, you know, when I was a kid, I feel like everyone who was a grown-up read the Star. A rainy day meant newspapers in that orange plastic, you know? Like, I do not feel, now that I am a grown-up, that this is even remotely the case. There's not, like, an agreement that all grown-ups read the newspaper. I would say most grown-ups consume news, but there isn't that shared source that everyone is turning to as kind of a daily ritual.
Absolutely. You know, those kind of water cooler conversations that revolved around what was in the newspaper that day. And by the way, let's not forget the Kansas City Times. There was, I mean, once upon a time, as Scott was alluding to, there were many newspapers in Kansas City, but by mid-century, last century, there were two, the Kansas City Times and Kansas City Star. They ultimately sort of worked under, I believe, a joint operating agreement and were later merged into one paper because TV had indeed eaten into profits, and evening newspapers, such as the Kansas City Star, were no longer as profitable. So what they did is they merged the two, and they carried the flag of the Star because that was the better known name, and it became a morning paper. But it just goes to show you, when they did that merger back in the early 90s, they basically didn't lay off anybody, at least initially, because notwithstanding how TV had eaten into their profits, it was still tolerable. So I just want to point out that back in 1992, when I was still at the Kansas City Business Journal, somebody anonymously sent me one of the Star's most closely guarded secrets, namely its income statement. I got it in the mail one day, and I saw it, and my eyes popped open, and I dug up the story I wrote in 1992, and just to give you an idea of the kind of money that the newspaper was making then, it indicated that for the first 11 months of that year, this was before December, which is the most profitable month, was the most profitable month for newspapers because of Christmas advertising. Just for the first 11 months, the Star had brought in $173 million in revenue. And extrapolating, that would have translated into $200 million plus in revenue for the year. And the income statement showed that the profit margin was 27%. Back in those days, at 25, 27, 30% profit margin for newspapers was not unusual. Now, I don't know what the Star is making today. For all I know, it's still profitable. But I guarantee you, it is not pulling in anything remotely like those kind of numbers, and it certainly doesn't have that kind of profit margin. So, I mean, what the internet did was utterly upend and disrupt a model that had been in effect for about 250 years. And now, we're seeing this ongoing shrinkage of newspapers. The layoffs you alluded to, or the buyouts you alluded to at the top of the program, Gina, I anticipate that there are going to be more layoffs. And as I said, right now the newsroom is down to about 65 people at the Star, and they're hiring more people, but they're young people out of school. So all that institutional experience is going out the door.
You know, before I move on, I do want to acknowledge, Dan, that every story you tell, it's like you're like the journalists in movies. Like just someone anonymously sends you the budget for the Kansas City Star.
That was such a weird experience. And I'll tell you, just if I may, is a funny story because I had to authenticate it. And knowing what one of these income statements looks like, after all, I was a business reporter, I had no doubt in my mind that it was authentic, but somehow I had proved that it was actually the Star statement. So I called the Star's then publisher, Jim Hale, a larger-than-life figure, a Texan. They don't make him in that mold anymore. And as if for all the world it was the most natural thing for me to be doing is looking at the Star's financial statements, I started talking to him about it, and I noticed that the newsprint costs had gone down, even though newsprint costs had been going up in general. And so I guessed that he had pulled off a hedging strategy, and I started flattering on that, and he said, "Pretty good, isn't it?" And that was my authentication. And then about midway through the conversation, he all of a sudden blurts out, "Hey, where'd you get that anyway?"
Like, I don't know. This all kind of – Dan was inspired to tell this story because of my question about not just where and whether people are getting their information, but I do also have this other question about having a thing that holds us together as a community in that way. Scott Reinhardy, can you talk about that aspect of a paper of record?
Oh, that's a great question. And when we talk about the decrease in readership, we're also talking about generational. If you see your parents reading the newspaper, then you read the newspaper. Well, we don't see that anymore. That's not happening. And what has happened with the cuts in the newsroom, and it's really what they call a death spiral. You have reduction in circulation, reduction in advertising to make up the difference in revenue. And Dan's absolutely right. The profit margins were unbelievable. If any of us received that kind of return on our investment, we'd be thrilled. But what happens to retrieve or to make up the difference of that loss in profit, they cut their staffs. And then what happens is the quality of what's being developed diminishes. And when the quality develops, you lose more audience, you lose more advertisers, and you continue to cut staff. So
this is the death spiral
It's a death spiral.
Not at all an alarming name.
Not at all. But it's been discussed for the last 20 years in research.
This isn't
anything new. But that's what you're seeing. That's what you're seeing with the Star. They've had so many cuts. And the Star isn't unique in that fashion. In my research, I've demonstrated that newspaper after newspaper after newspaper has continued to cut its staff.
Is there any explanation for that generational shift that people who observed their – that for generations, people who observed their parents reading the paper read the paper too, and that you're not seeing that now. What do you – is that the internet too, or is that something else?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. First off, it was a lot of that was afternoon newspapers. People, men particularly, would come home in the afternoon and read their newspaper, and their family would see those men read their newspapers. But as technology grew, as television expanded, cable television expanded, more options to find news, people started consuming news differently. So that was a slow erosion that began in the late 70s, early 80s, when you started to see the evolution of television and the evolution of cable television. So you start losing that institutional practice of newspaper readership throughout. And what that does to a community is it does separate your community, because people now are receiving information from different places and have different ideas about what it really means to talk about healthcare in a community, or what it really means to talk about taxes in a community, because they're not just reading the same thing or on the same page. And you probably can even look at migration in this country, how people have moved to pockets of areas of like-minded people, for the most part, politically speaking. But newspapers held that together, because everyone was, for the most part, consuming news from the same location, the paper of record. And if you're receiving that information and you trust that information, you make the presumption that that information is, in fact, factual and we're all in this together. Well, that isn't the case anymore. The audiences are fractured. The information distribution has been fractured. So you have a fracturing of ideas and community as well.
How does that play out in, say, politics or business, in those arenas?
Oh, well, we have massive divisions. Newspapers are always seen as at least making the effort to try to be objective. Now, we can discuss the notions of objectivity, but we won't go into that. But the fact of the matter is that if people are just gravitating towards the sources of which support their thought process or their thought beliefs, well, then they're not receiving any other conversations or having any other conversations that may differ, or actually may be presenting all the facts, or they may not be consuming information that distorting the facts, or just leaving facts out.
I'm interested in this earlier time period you described, when there were tons and tons of print sources. That sounds sort of like the abundance of online news sources. And that people eventually kind of self-corrected, because just having many sources of information isn't wrong in and of itself, but that desire for the authoritative, credible news source sort of emerged organically out of that. Do you foresee something like that? I guess, and really specifically, this idea of the authoritative news source.
Sure. That's pretty complicated. I'm not sure we'll ever see it to the extent we saw it at newspapers. And when those newspapers started to dominate, it was because they were bigger, they were better, they were able to produce more information. So they kind of grabbed the market hold and say, we're the reliable ones. Going forward, I'm not sure you'll ever find that kind of singularity again.
Scott Reinhardy, stay with me through the break, okay?
Certainly.
And Dan Margulies, health editor and legal affairs reporter for KCUR, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
In just a minute, is the future of journalism, digital journalism, everything it was cracked up to be? You tell us. That's next. You can join the conversation at 816-235-2888. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we were just talking about the history of the paper of record in this country. Now let's look at what was supposed to step in and be the future of what print news, on some level, used to be: digital journalism. It is not quite looking like such a sure thing right now. In fact, there was one week this year when online journalism racked up about 1,000 layoffs split between companies like BuzzFeed, HuffPost, and Vox. So that seems significant and worth talking about in and of itself. Let's bring Hannah Wise in on this discussion. She's the national expert with us from the Dallas Morning News. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, good morning, Gina.
So before we get into the future of digital journalism, I do want to acknowledge that digital journalism, for all that we just heard about the paper of record declining and what was lost with that, there is also this opportunity that people were responding to tell stories that had been left out of the record. Do you see that as kind of the promise of digital journalism?
I do. I think it's so exciting. When I think about the paper of record, I think about very like-minded people making the paper for people that look and sound like them. So when you talk about a local newspaper, you're talking about a community. But within that larger community, so Dallas or Kansas City, there are smaller groups within that. There are sub-communities. And is the newspaper really speaking to all of those groups? Is it serving them as well as the majority? And I'd argue that newspapers didn't. And so you have a lack of trust in between these communities and the newspaper. And there's a void of information that the internet gives everyone the opportunity to be a publisher and to tell their stories and to share information. But with that comes danger in that journalists are trained in how to share information and how to do so ethically and responsibly, and your neighbor may not have that training. So how do we grapple with that as a community is something I think about a lot.
You are what's called an audience development editor, and you actually pitched your own job. Can you tell that story?
Yeah. So before I was our audience development editor, I was our engagement editor, the first ever at the newspaper. And before that, I was a breaking news reporter covering politics and protests at the Dallas Morning News. And I was working in 2016 covering Donald Trump, things like that, and Black Lives Matter protests in Dallas. And the July 7th police shooting happened during my shift. And I'd been assigned to cover the protests that turned into the shooting. And I was live on Facebook during all of this. And my training, I'm a graduate of the University of Kansas, and my training kicked in. And I said, I don't want to show someone's dead body on this broadcast. How do I do this? And I was just thinking through, and I met a woman on the street who I was like, first, are you safe? I'm still live interviewing her. And I said, why did you come here? What did you see? And she said, I wanted to bring my children to show them how to protest peacefully. And I didn't see children around her. And I said, where are your kids? And they were hiding underneath a car. So that they would stay safe, and she was going to go and get them. And in that moment, and then the days after, I just was wondering, are we really communicating with all of the people that live in North Texas? Are we helping them better understand their community, live more equitable lives? And it made me think I need to do something different. And I went to the Online News Association conference that fall and saw some folks from ProPublica give a discussion about engagement journalism and how they collected responses from more than 4,000 veterans to tell stories about how Agent Orange affected these people's lives. And that I walked out of the room and went to my boss and said, hi, I know the job that I want and I'd like to design it. So it's something that combines reporting, listening to the community, and designing products and projects that are focused on individual community members and audience first.
Can you explain to me what it was about this woman showing you that her children were hiding under the car because she thought she was coming to a peaceful protest to sort of inspire them? What about that made you want to do something differently? What about that made you think differently about what you knew about your community and what you were communicating to your community?
I think it helps that I am a transplant here. I'm from Wichita originally, and I've lived in Dallas now about 5 years. It'd been about 3 years then. And I lived in downtown, and I saw this woman who had come from a different part of Dallas to participate in this. She seemed unfamiliar with the area, looked and felt scared. And we had the same feeling that something terrible had happened to this place that we call home. And it just made me really wonder, like, are we are we answering or are we asking the right questions about what leads people to decide that protest is necessary? How are they organizing? What can we learn from what they're saying? And how can we actively listen? And then if you're bringing your children, how can we also tell them about their community? And how can we listen to their concerns?
How does digital journalism fit into the answers to those questions?
I think that it gives you a way to reach more people, frankly, with less money. Everyone has largely access to a smartphone now. However, I do think about how do we reach people that have less internet access. But we can say, what do you want to know about the mayoral election in Dallas? Or what questions do you have about life on both sides of the border between the U.S. and Mexico? I think for a long time, journalists, they are so knowledgeable. We talk to experts. We talk to politicians. We talk to leaders in different communities. And so we have this feeling that we know what's going on and we know the information that people need and that people want. But you have people moving to a community all the time and your community is changing. So just because you've written something once doesn't mean that everyone has read it. And so by inviting the community to participate and to tell you what they want to know, it's humbling, frankly, to think that you thought that you were this expert and this knowledgeable source, but sometimes you're making assumptions about that.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it sounds like when we've talked about the paper of record, there has been a disruption of a sense of shared knowledge, but there's also been a disruption of assumptions.
Yeah. So, for example, I edit a project called Curious Texas that is the embodiment of this idea. And in it, we invite people to ask us questions or just tell us things, not necessarily a news tip, but just, I saw this weird thing and I don't know if it's anything worth it, but I wanted you to know about it. And it gives us the opportunity to make sure that we are listening to people who are not in our core coverage area, and to double check our gut plans about covering something. So the mayoral race here in Dallas is big. It's the first one that we've had in many years, and there are 9 candidates. And so we have lots. Dallas has changed tons since that last race. And so we wanted to make sure that we were covering things that people wanted to know. So I believe Kansas City also has a weak mayor system.
Yes.
And so we wrote an explainer last week that said, what does the mayor do? And we talked to former mayors.
We totally had this conversation on the radio.
Yeah. It's so good and it's so smart. And we've had people say, wow, thank you so much. I had no idea that the city manager is actually the person with the most power in City Hall. And then things like just goofy stories that you wouldn't expect would be something that people wanted to know about. We have a series of tunnels underneath downtown Dallas that it's kind of a rumor for a lot of people in the suburbs or even people who have lived here a long time. And someone asked, like, is there a mall underneath downtown Dallas? And so we took them along with us to go and explore these tunnels and like eat at Chick-fil-A. But that's a story that someone wanted answered. But when I think about the training that I got in journalism school, that isn't answering like a question of traditional newsworthiness, but it became one of our most read stories in this project on DallasNews.com.
Okay, so Hannah, hang on with me. I want to turn back to Scott Reinhardy of the KU School of Journalism. Welcome back, first of all.
Oh, thank you.
And I'd like to get some response to just sort of connecting some dots here, because one thing we've talked about in our conversation about change to the whole concept of the paper of record, and in Kansas City, the Kansas City Star. That we heard from Dan Margulies that huge layoffs have shrunk a newsroom way down and have reduced what that newsroom is actually capable of covering. Is what Hannah is describing partly the other side of that? Is that, well, okay, the newsroom cannot do it all. How do you get the community telling the stories.
Oh, absolutely. Hi, Hannah. Nice to hear from you.
Hi.
Hannah's one of my students a number of years ago. She is now schooling me on some of this information. But yes, what they are doing at the Dallas Morning News is rather impressive in terms of trying to get the audience re-engaged into what's happening. And what we're talking about, traditional journalism would have us, that one of the last things that we really examine is things that are interesting. We look at facts, we look at things people need to know, we look at information that is important to a democracy, but the interesting always seems to be the last rung of that ladder. And I think what they're doing at the Dallas Morning News and the projects that Hannah is heading up looks at things that are interesting, that people, that affects people's daily lives. So again, you're allowing the community to have a say in what's happening, and you're re-engaging a community that was always just receiving news from a newspaper and not necessarily having a participatory active role in that newspaper.
So business model wise, how would you describe the arc of the story of, so we're hearing some of the potential of digital journalism, which I think most people at this point do appreciate. But what, how would you describe business model wise the arc of the story of digital journalism leading up to this moment that we are in?
Well, if you're talking economics, again, if you don't have an audience, it's hard to generate revenue. What the Dallas Morning News and others are doing is, again, re-engaging an audience, which will, again, news and information is a product, just like any other product. And if that product, it can be monetized in a lot of different ways. So what you're seeing is, without that engagement in that audience, understanding who your audience is and reaching out to that audience, there is no second step to that in trying to gain revenue or at least have interest and readership in what you're doing to continue to do what you intend to do, provide the community with information that is needed and of great interest.
So, Hannah, we're hearing about the arc of the story of digital journalism leading up to the moment we are in. What do you see happening right now in digital journalism from a business standpoint? I mentioned a little while ago this week that happened in this year that we are in, where there were about 1,000 layoffs over the span of very well-known online media outlets.
Yes. And I should say that in that week or the week before, the Dallas Morning News also had layoffs. So it really is everywhere. And it is causing a lot of anxiety in newsrooms everywhere. And when I think about the business model, we have moved in the last few years from a traditional advertising-based business model to one that is subscription-fueled. So we have a pay meter on the website that you get a number of articles for free every month. I think we're down to like between 3 and 5. And so that gives people enough to say, I like this. I trust this news source, and I have created a habit, part of habituating people. I think that's a big question is, how do you redevelop this habit that people had to read the morning or the afternoon newspaper? Instead, now, how do you get them to go to your website? Something that can be incredibly powerful in doing that is an email newsletter. I'm sure that many of your listeners get at least one newsletter from some sort of news source.
Probably KCUR.org's Early Bird.
Hopefully, sign up if you do not. But for us, we have seen great growth in being able to say, you read our twice daily newsletter, and then you get a little bit of the story in each newsletter, and then you can click
Hannah,
to learn more.
I'm going to jump in here because you're talking about the solution to a problem that I don't think we've really described to our listeners. What is it that's going
Indeed.
On right now?
I would say that people have they forget, frankly, they forget that they need this news source. So people are seeing something on Twitter or on Facebook, or they heard their friend talk about it, but they're not going back to the source. And so we need to reintroduce ourselves to our communities and to our audience, and to then get them to either subscribe to the online edition or to the print edition, or to become a member of public radio.
People are getting secondhand news.
Yes. So we want to be their first source.
Scott, jump in.
Yeah, and this is something. In the last 6 months, we've had three local communities approach our school to say there's a real recognition that they are not, those people in those communities are not receiving the information that they need or want.
Can you tell me what communities you're talking about?
I'd prefer not to at this time because we are in the midst of working with some projects, but they are larger communities around the Kansas City area that these are business leaders, these are government officials coming to us saying, our community no longer has a solid news source. How can you help us develop one? So there's a real acknowledgement that something is lacking in that community, that where citizens are now seeing the problems that these cuts and layoffs have created. So they're looking for news sources, reliable news sources.
Hannah Wise, Scott Ryanardi, hang on just a moment. We have to take one more break. You still have a little time to call 816-235-2888. You can talk about the change you have witnessed in journalism in your lifetime, what it means to you. But there's just a little time, so you have to do it now if you're going to do it. 816-235-2888. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Hannah Wise of the Dallas Morning News and Scott Ryanardi of KU's School of Journalism. Scott is the author of a book called Journalism's Lost Generation, The Undoing of U.S. Newspaper Newsrooms. Hi again, you two.
Hello.
Hi. How are you?
So we were just talking about communities, Scott, reaching out to you, recognizing that they needed there was a certain crucial amount or type of information they weren't getting. And wanting to sort of remedy that, people want news.
They certainly do. And what was interesting about these conversations, or what is interesting about these conversations, is the people who are coming to us may be business leaders or government officials, but they're not looking to control the news. They're just simply saying our citizens are not informed enough to make decisions when they go to the polling booth, when we're talking about tax abatements, or if we're talking about raising property taxes, or what's happening in our schools. We just are not receiving enough information or that kinds of information. The complication, clearly, again, is the business model. And we've talked about several different models, everything from a donation system, a wealthy benefactor coming forward is unlikely scenario, but even looking at grants from national organizations, some kind of pay model. There are different ways we're looking to try to help develop that. And along with our school, where we have an army of students who are learning journalism, it may not be top-shelf, high-quality journalism some days, but there's a willingness to learn and understand and help provide some of that coverage in those communities. We may be able to develop a partnership, or we expect to be able to develop a partnership that can help out these communities.
Let's talk to Larry, who is calling us from Overland Park. Hi, Larry.
Hello. My question is, or comment, is that a lot of the news sources, Apple is a perfect example, they predetermine based on what you've looked at in the past, what they think will be interesting, and that's what they present you. And that irritates me because I'm pretty well read, and I like to look at a wide variety of different items, and it seems like I'm being narrowed to what I actually can be seen.
So thank you, Larry. Hannah, as someone who works in digital journalism, is that something that you wrestle with, like how to stay a couple steps away ahead of algorithms and things like that?
Yes, Larry, thank you for your question. This is so smart. And it's something I'm really concerned about. When I talk about we want to be the person or the organization that you're coming to for the news, we hope that you are reaching out directly to your news organization, and reading your news there. But inevitably, there's a lot of money to be made by the platforms that they know that you're looking for news and information, and they know that news organizations are producing it. And so if they can repackage it in a way, to present it to you, the consumer, when you are a frequent Facebook user or you own an Apple device, they have you already kind of tied in to their ecosystem, and news organizations are having to work really hard to develop the relationship with you that some of these platforms have.
So like that log into your computer in the morning or your phone or whatever, and that the first thing you go to is not Facebook or Twitter or Google, that it would be a media outlet. It would be the immediate source of the news information.
Exactly. And when you talk about Apple, as Larry did, they've launched this news service that they are taking 50% of the subscription money. So very few local outlets are going to be participating in that. I think mostly national magazines have opted to, hoping that they will get the scale that Apple can provide. But for local, I'm not going to necessarily be able to know that I'm reaching people in my immediate community who would have the most investment in the work that we are producing.
Let's talk quickly to John in Overland Park. John has his own personal cautionary note. Hi, John.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my phone call. I should probably say that I had a long history in the advertising business in New York City, and I'm very familiar with the concept of targeted marketing, which is kind of central to this whole matter of a business model. Where people pay for what they want, which makes a lot of sense. The problem with that is people do pay for what they want, not what they need. And I think when we take the business of journalism to the point where it's all about finding those people that only want to hear or only want to receive what they want to hear as opposed to what they need to hear, I think our First Amendment is in extreme jeopardy.
Okay, John, I'm going to jump in here. This is an interesting kind of tension because there is we've heard about how many news outlets there are. There's competition, but then the things news organizations might consider doing to attract the most eyes or get the largest audience or hold the audience, that's maybe in the category of entertainment. I'm not opposed to entertainment, but is there tension between that? And yeah, maybe this story isn't fun, but like someone needs to tell it because it's really, really important. Scott?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Yeah, and John's correct. We get this echo chamber effect where if all we're chasing is the news we want to hear or we want to see, then we never really venture outside that and receive the news that we actually need. Huge problem. And it's interesting to note, historically, you're looking at the founding fathers with the First Amendment particularly wanted to look at an open marketplace of ideas. Well, the internet has provided that. And what we've learned is we self-select and we segregate ourselves off into areas that we like and agree with and don't ever look outside of that echo chamber. That's incredibly problematic.
So it's like the cafeteria in high school.
It's exactly like the cafeteria. And you can even talk in terms of you know, desegregation in this country. We desegregated for the most part, but people still self-segregate. And that's what we're doing with information. We're self-segregating into areas that will continue to divide us and create additional problems. I do not have a solution for that by any means. People are going to select what they select. The best that journalists can do is provide the necessary information to continue to participate in the democracy.
You know, Hannah, as we've discussed, digital journalism was supposed to be what was going to replace if the daily paper was in trouble, that's okay. New platform, same idea. We're still providing the news. If digital journalism is struggling, what fills that hole?
That is a great question. If someone out there knows the answer, I would love to hear it. But I still think that digital journalism it will change. We are constantly iterating. We have more information than ever before about what the audience actually is reading and what they are interested in. And that coupled with journalistic expectations of being a watchdog in your community, in covering the city council meeting. That's really important work for us to do. When we read a story online, or when we write one, we can see immediately what are people reading. When we think about the city council, so I talked about the mayoral race being important. We, instead of focusing on the institution, we're focusing on the people and what do they want? What are they asking?
Someone still has to pay you to do all that work, though, right?
Indeed. That's why we need to have this deep relationship with them, so they will feel compelled to pay.
Well, I highly recommend fund drives. Hannah Wise, Scott Reinhardy, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hannah joined us from the Dallas Morning News, where she's an audience development editor. Scott is a journalism professor at KU, and Hannah happened to study with him when she went to KU. That's a wrap. You can listen back to this conversation if there's anything you missed at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have it ready for you later today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we will be hearing heroic stories of ordinary Kansas Cityans from Central Standard's Best Ofs. We will listen to some of our most inspiring guests tell stories of taking risks, being themselves, bringing people joy in really unexpected ways. It's going to feel good. Listen in. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.